Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, let's get started.
Motor Talk with Toby Hagan.
Yes, Toby Hagan, timing to chat cars and car culture. Toby's gone up in the world. He's now editor of evcentral.com.au. Check this website out, EV, capital E, capital V, evcentral.com.au. It's an independent website which focuses on electric and hydrogen cars. And if you wanted to know anything about it, how they work, and what's in the market, it's a very good place to go and visit. Toby, good evening. Welcome back.
Thanks, Phil. Good evening.
Yes. Well, this looks exciting, this new venture. You've been obviously, while in lockdown, been getting yourself busy, have you?
I have, yeah. It's amazing what you can get up to when you haven't got a whole lot of other stuff to do. Obviously, a lot of what I do has generally been travelling and trying out new cars and that sort of stuff, and there really hasn't been anything like that in the last 3 or 4 months. It's been a pretty subdued market. So me and some colleagues decided to start up a website and decided to focus on that electric car side of it and the electric and hydrogen vehicles and plug-in hybrids and all those sorts of things, which is, it's where the market's going. I mean, yes, it's going to be a slow road. It's going to be a long time till we're all driving one of those things, but that's certainly where we're heading over the next many decades.
Yes, well, exactly. That's absolutely right. It's weird, isn't it? Did you see that news out today about Tesla is now on? I mean, this is shows you a couple of things. One, how divorced the stock market is from the real world in a way. Tesla on the stock market is now officially the world's most valuable car company, even though it has never made a profit. It surpasses Toyota, who last year made $1 billion in profit. And according to the market, Tesla's worth way more than Toyota. Make sense of that for me.
Well, I can't make sense of it at all. It's crazy. You look at it now and look at the value, as you say. I mean, Tesla is now valued at $207 billion US dollars, just outstripping Toyota, $202 billion. But put it in perspective, Tesla, as you say, never made an annual profit. They are tantalizingly close, and indeed we should figure that out. Around about now, I mean, they just finished, obviously, the financial year. They actually hit a profit for the first 3 months of the previous financial year. And Elon Musk sent out quite a strange email to his staff about a week or so ago saying, come on, push, try and really put in every effort you can to try and get us over the line and at least break even. Now, assuming he's meaning break even for that fourth quarter, the one that's just finished. But, he's saying, look, try and break even. And the entire annual profit for the company is looking like being around about $250 million US dollars. So tiny compared with the value of the company. I mean, a return on investment, it's something like 0.1% return on investment. So it's a return on investment, sorry. I mean, it's just crazy. But look, obviously, the stock market is betting on where Tesla's going. Tesla's had some huge capital investments over the last the last 2 or 3 years in particular, setting up new factories and so on. So it's been an enormous one from that perspective, trying to invest in what is extremely expensive stuff, getting manufacturing plants up and running, battery facilities and so on.
Sure, sure.
So they've had these huge costs.
Yeah. I know you've covered that. So tell us about the new website, EV Central, capital E, capital V, central.com. What are you trying to do here, Toby?
Well, we're trying to help out not only the people who are very into this technology, and there are some people very devoted to it, but the number of people, and part of it is this show that's given me the incentive for it, the amount of people who are interested in this technology, not necessarily going to buy a car tomorrow, but certainly interested in it, thinking, well, where can we, what are the options out there now? And obviously the options aren't terrific at the moment, but the next year or two in particular is going to be enormous for electric vehicles. So there's a lot going on there. Just to try and give people an understanding, try and break down some of the technology. We've got some terrific writers who are great at making some of the complex things that or the jargon associated with these cars, making it, putting it into everyday terms. So we've tried to tackle it from that perspective as well. And as I said, put a really good buyer's guide in there and cover off everything that's happening with electric vehicles.
Yeah. No, it's very interesting. So if you want to have a check it out, evcentral.com.au. All right, now, after months and months of gloomy news, the June car sales figures are out tomorrow. The word is it was a big month. How come?
Well, huge month, yeah. I mean, looks like everyone's playing a bit of catch-up. I've spoken to about five or six of the big brands, yeah, and they're all saying it has just been boom times, particularly for the last two or three weeks. One of the brands said the biggest challenge they've had in the last couple of weeks is finding enough trucks to try and deliver the new cars to their owners. So it has been just an enormous challenge for the industry playing that catch up. And of course, you go back two or three months, and obviously the doom and gloom kicking around, and the lack of any sort of history to look at here in terms of what may or may not happen has really challenged all the product planners and people ordering and so on. So it's now a game of catch up to a large extent. A lot of the car makers are trying to work out where they've got stock, how quickly they can get hold of stock, and obviously try and start meeting that demand. So they're all saying it, just the turnaround's just been enormous. Now, you know, I guess there could be another blip too, as we're seeing obviously with the virus itself in Victoria. So maybe things will be tempered again. But at the moment, it's they're certainly smiling a lot more than they were a month or two ago.
Yeah, well, exactly. All right. Kia's revealed its all-new Carnival, which arrives later this year. What's it? What's this?
Well,
I love this. It's got a new name too. It's a GUV.
we've gone acronym crazy here, Phil. It's just madness. Like, you can't just have an SUV or a CUV or any of these other terms they come up with. They've come up with grand utility vehicle for the Carnival. But look, Carnival's the top selling people mover in the country. It displaced the Toyota Tarago about 8 or 10 years ago now in terms of outright sales. So it's a very popular car with families, with rental car fleets, and so on. So there's a lot of interest there for that sort of car, and they've just revealed the next generation model. So this is a car that will arrive in Australia in the next few months. I think it's around September, October, due in Australia. Doesn't mess with the formula a whole lot, but what it has done is changed the styling enormously. So they've gone for a lot bolder, a lot sharper edges. It looks like a larger vehicle, and clearly the US market has been an influence here. They've said that they've tried to incorporate some SUV styling, so I guess try to get some design pizzazz into these cars, which, let's face it, most people movers look pretty dull and boring. No one really aspires to owning a people mover.
No.
So they're trying to make it a little bit sexier. So it's pretty clear from my perspective looking at it. Obviously, America's had an enormous influence here in terms of the overall styling. It's going to be, as I said, the basic formula doesn't change. Still got 8 seats, still got a heap of space.
You could be the first on the block to have a GUV.
That's right, absolutely. Everyone will be launching over themselves for that.
Now, car keys and losing your car keys and trying to find them when you've got somewhere to go in a hurry, as we know, is one of life's great problems. First world issue, I know. However, the car key is getting closer to a digital grave, isn't it? There's car makers muck around with being able to operate your car with your phone.
Oh, it is a bit. I mean, if you think about the concept of a key, and obviously we've got smart keys these days in cars where you leave the key in your pocket or your bag and walk up to the car and it just opens when it senses the key.
Lots of cars have got those, haven't they? Yeah. What are they called? Near field things, aren't they?
Or smart? Yeah. Oh no. Well, smart keys. Yeah. Near field communication. But this, we're all heading, I think, in the next probably 5 or 10 years, car keys will disappear altogether. And
really?
We're starting to see the start of that now so Apple came out and did an update to its operating system, the iOS system behind the phone. They've included a new feature in there called Car Key, which I guess does what it says on the box. They haven't really tried to muck around with any fancy marketing there. And it basically uses that near field communication. Once the phone is near the car, you can use your phone to unlock the car, to start the car, and away you go. So really? Obviously then...
Does that retrofit it? I mean, would that work on, say, I don't know, like a Mazda 3, which has got a keyless entry at the moment? I mean, would that...
No. So you have to have the technology in the car.
Yeah.
So BMW is going to be the first brand to offer it in Australia and around the world, I believe.
Okay.
And they're saying all cars manufactured from July 1, so yesterday. So all cars basically manufactured from now will have the functionality of it. Then you've obviously got to have the phone, and then make sure it all works. But quite a few advantages to this technology. So one of them being you can send digital keys to friends or family. So let's say you're out and about, someone gets back to the car before you. You can say, hang on a minute, I'll send you a key. Bang, they get it on their phone, and away they go.
And you could give other family members the car key, as it were.
Yeah.
So if you lose your phone, you could say, look, can you just Oh, no, absolutely. That's not going to work, though, is it? Because they can't open the phone from their place miles away. No. Open the car.
No, not like that. But you can already do that with cars now. So that you can unlock the cars now in terms of the technology for remotely unlocking it, provided it's within mobile phone range. But the other thing, one of the more interesting parts of this technology, I think, is that you can then set the car up to limit things like power, top speed, the volume of the sound system. So let's say your P-plater teenager is about to go and drive the car. You can set the car up for them to drive in a very different way it did for you. So you could have a very high-performance car, limit the power quite substantially from their perspective, and, as I said, make it so they can't have the volume on full blaring, listening to their favourite songs. So it's so that sort of technology, I think, is really cool in cars. And it amazes me that they haven't done this sooner, that sort of thing sooner, because the technology's been there. It's been... You can tailor the rest of the car to various keys and so on. So this is just taking it a step further. But as I said, the car key generally, I mean, it'll be a little bit of a slow rollout, I think, with this, but we'll get there eventually. It's also worth keeping in mind that similar technology has been available in Teslas for some time. They've made them work with iPhones where you just walk up to it and open the car. And they've actually got a backup with that. So instead of, obviously, if your phone dies, if you lose your phone, if it runs out of batteries, it causes issues potentially. So Tesla has a effect. It's about a credit card size thing you just leave in your wallet, and if you need to, you can hold that up against a certain part on the exterior of the car, and it'll unlock the car, and you use that to get in. So there will inevitably have to be backups with this sort of technology. It's as there is with smart keys now. I mean, a lot of cars don't necessarily have the keyholes visible. They don't necessarily have them where they were. So, but they've always got a mechanical backup there somewhere, just in case the key itself dies.
Well, I suppose it's the thing, isn't it? I mean, there's been a move away in the world, hasn't there, from things that only do one thing, you know, radios that only get radio stations, for example, and car keys that only do one thing, which is unlock your car, are seen as a bit old hat, you know.
Yeah, that's right. And people are expecting more from them. And this is one of the big moves with vehicles generally, obviously, is connectivity. People are far less concerned what is under the bonnet these days. They're more concerned about how this car will work from a digital perspective, how they can talk to the car, all the voice recognition. And a lot of them are getting better at that. None of them have nailed it yet. BMW, Mercedes-Benz would like you to think they have, but they're still a long way off. But they've got systems where you can ask the car, or you can start telling the car different things. You say things like, "Hey, Mercedes, I'm cold," and it'll turn the heating up and maybe close the windows, that sort of thing. So they're trying to get some of that artificial intelligence going on. Still got a long way to go with it, but that's certainly where we're heading with it. We're going to end up with much smarter cars, hopefully, where we don't have to learn what they need us to learn, where they can learn from just general speech and normal conversations and trying to work out what we need from that. But sometimes I maybe think they get a little bit too tricky. You end up creating functions that are a little bit useless. They're more a show your friends sort of thing rather than anything that you're going to use every day.
Speaking of tech, the autonomous car, the self-driving car, I know you've been pretty sceptical about any early arrival for this thing for a while, and indeed your judgment seems to be being borne out. At least two big makers, BMW and Mercedes, have said, well, yeah, maybe not for a while.
No, not for a long while, I think. I mean, they jumped into bed together to develop this technology. I mean, these are two obviously rival brands, said we're going to share development costs, share some of the back-end technology, and then try and bring the tech to market obviously sooner. They've now said, and blamed a little bit on coronavirus, but they've said they're having a pause to their partnership. So they haven't quite said they've cancelled it, but I don't think many people are expecting it to fire back up again. Obviously, they've realised there are some significant barriers here to what's going on. There may have been some differences of opinion going on behind the scenes, but really it does sound like it's getting all a bit too difficult. And you know, we were pretty much promised driverless cars by now, fully driverless cars,
totally.
get in the car
totally.
And away you go.
I know. And no amount of scepticism by me or you would hose these people down who just looked at you as though it was some sort of old dinosaur. And you know, they're not going to be here for years.
That's right. I mean, and we are so far away from it. I mean, you look at it now, the most advanced semi-autonomous cars we've got on the road now are level 2 of level 5. And arguably the most difficult stages are level 3, 4, and 5. So it's so we're a long, long way off it. And it's, I think ultimately that we'll get there. I mean, you see how far we've come in the last 20 or 30 years with vehicle development and the technology in cars, I think we will get there. But it's many years away. There's still a long way to go to make it make the technology safe enough and reliable enough that people will start to trust it. And that's one of the big challenges with all this stuff is people trusting the technology. At the moment, there is a distrust in terms of the leaving everything to a computer. Yes, humans make a lot of mistakes. Computers make fewer mistakes, but you'd rather humans would rather take the risk and know that they're in charge. And if there is a mistake, it's their fault, not some ones and zeros flying the wrong way.
Yeah, exactly. All right, just quickly before we get to some calls, the BT50 Ute, which is a venerable Ute from Mazda, of course, they've unveiled a new one, and it's interesting, apparently.
It is interesting. I mean, if you look at the way that Ute market has gone, and I guess you look at the two big sellers, the Ford Ranger and the Toyota Hilux, and they're all about big, macho, butch, pretty bold styling. And the Mazda doesn't have anything like that. They've really tried to incorporate a lot of their passenger car styling into a Ute. So when you actually look at the car from the direct front on, you look straight down the nose of it, it's pretty hard to tell it apart from a lot of the regular passenger cars. So it's a fairly similar looking thing. So I'm not entirely convinced, I've got to be honest. I mean, yes, there'll probably be some of the market that says, okay, I don't need something that really stands out as boldly as some of those other ones do. But at the same time, I think a lot of people will say, hang on, that's not the big tough truck that I want. So who knows? They might carve out a really nice niche for themselves off to the side. But there'll certainly be some that say, oh, that's not quite butch enough for me. That said, I mean, one of the things with Utes is the customization. Very few Utes these days leave the dealership and don't have something done to them, whether it's might be as simple as a tow bar or some wheels, you know, some chunkier wheels, that sort of thing. But a lot of people do more than that. They go and put different grills on them and wheel arch flares and all sorts of stuff. So there's a lot that goes on, and the aftermarket will no doubt look after part of that and say, okay, we can butch it up for you. We can make it look more serious than it is now. So there'll be a bit of that going on as well. But as I said, it just doesn't have that. It's a very different approach to what a lot of the other Ute manufacturers have taken.
Okie doke. All right, let's get to some calls. Ask Toby anything you like. No valuations, no mechanicals. You can work that out for yourself. Plenty of places to look up for that sort of stuff. Anything else? Well, Sharon's first up. Hi, Sharon.
Hello.
Hi.
Looking for a used car for my son. He's had a Camry. We bought him a Camry about 8 years ago. It was 2000, so it's 20 years old and it's done him really well.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I was looking at around, he wants to spend about 12,000 to 14,000. Mm-hmm. I've seen some Camry Altice 2014 that had 70,000 Ks on the clock, one owner, which I was thinking was pretty good. But he's thinking maybe a Kia Cerato 2018 for about the same price. I was wondering probably what you think would be better.
I think you're looking in two excellent parts of the market. So obviously with the Kia, it's classified as a small sedan, whereas the Camry is a mid-size sedan. So in particularly in the rear seats, you got a lot more space in the Camry. So if he's carrying a lot of mates around a lot of the time, then the Camry's going to do a better job. But if it's mainly him and maybe one or two other friends, then I would certainly be going the Kia for two main reasons. One is, so it's going to have a little bit less power. It's, as I said, it's going to be smaller, those sorts of things. But it came with a 7-year warranty. So you buy a 2018 model, you've still got 5 years of factory warranty on that car. So 5 years of anything goes wrong, take it back to the dealership and they will hopefully attend to it. Mm. The second thing is the technology and so on in there. So it's going to benefit from some of the active safety systems. You'll be on the cusp there in terms of, depending on the model you buy and the exact age of the car, it was around about then that Kia started putting some of those autonomous emergency braking and that sort of thing into the car. So you'll be able to get more of those active safety systems as well, and indeed connectivity. Things like Apple CarPlay came around. If it wasn't then, it wasn't far off then. So again, you'll have better connectivity and so on. That said,
the Camry is more reliable than a Kia?
I wouldn't say either way, to be honest. I think they're both among the more reliable cars on the market. So, yes, Toyota absolutely has the reputation of having better reliability, and very few of them ever come across issues. But the recent cars from both Hyundai and Kia, and I say recent being the last, say, 6, 8, 10 years, also have a very good good reputation for reliability. Look, if you're talking about, you know, making them last 20 years plus and do 300,000 or 400,000 Ks, then yes, the Toyota might have a slight edge. But as I said, having that factory warranty there for the next 5 years on a secondhand car is certainly a big advantage. So and you're also going to use a little bit less fuel in the Kia as well. Smaller car, smaller engine, so it's going to help out a bit in that regard. Yeah, they'll both have. I'm just trying to think. The Kia actually may have had a 4-star safety rating back then, whereas the Camry almost certainly would have had a 5-star rating. But don't get too wrapped up in that. So the NCAP safety ratings, the Australasian New Car Assessment Program, the main safety rating organisation, in the last few years, they've really ramped up the focus on active safety systems and extra features, things like daytime running lights and so on. So in terms of either of those cars crashing into a wall, protecting their occupants in a crash, they will both do an excellent job. They've both got a good structure. They've both got good airbag protection, all that sort of stuff. Where Kia and Hyundai on some of their lower models saved a bit of money was not putting on some of the little features that ticked the box with the NCAP people and therefore gave it a 5-star rating of the more recent 5-star ratings. So the rating system has been harder to get 5 stars, has got progressively more difficult. And as I said, some of those Kias and Hyundais made the decision to keep the price down, miss out a few features, and still have a 5-star rating. So yes, I would say safety-wise, they will both be very close, very similar in terms of safety, even if one of them only gets a 4-star safety rating.
Okay, all right, Sharon, good luck with it. Thanks for the question. Joe, hello. G'day, Joe.
Oh, hi. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Toby, I'd like to get Toby's opinion on some cars. I've been reading a lot of reviews, and they're doing my head in. I need a car that is smooth driving, you know, absorbing the bumps, because my wife has health issues, and she needs to have a smooth ride. Otherwise, we can't travel very far. And I've been looking at the Mazda CX-30 and the Kia Seltos.
Seltos,
I was just wondering what your opinion is on those two. Or is there a better car that's got a smoother driving history?
Do you need an SUV, like a higher riding car like that?
My wife likes them.
Okay. Yeah. So the only reason I'm asking that is what has tended to happen. The modern SUVs, the car makers have done a very good job of making them drive almost like a passenger car in terms of their cornering and their stability and so on.
Yeah.
Part of the way they've done that is by firming up the suspension a little bit. So they've actually, in raising, if you imagine they're sitting a little bit higher off the ground, so the center of gravity is slightly higher than it is on a regular passenger car. And as a result, the suspension on most of them is just a fraction firmer than it might be on some of their regular passenger cars. So if your outright goal is compliance in the suspension and getting that more cushy ride going on, then as a general rule, and there are exceptions to the rule, but as a general rule, you're almost better off looking at some of the regular passenger cars. It was made recently. I did an Audi launch where we drove some of their wagons, so their regular passenger car wagons, and straight after that drove some of their SUVs, and these had the same sort of performance focus, and it was very obvious in the passenger cars that they were more compliant and more comfortable, and just purely because of that lower center of gravity. So. So look, of those two cars you're looking at, they're both among the best of those small to mid-sized SUVs. There'd be two that I'd throw on the list straight away. Another two to stick on the list would be a Nissan Juke and a Toyota CHR. So those four would be the standouts in that class. And the Nissan Juke, incidentally, has just gone on sale. It's well worth a look. A little 3-cylinder turbo engine, and it's a massive step up from where the previous Juke was. It wasn't a particularly impressive car to drive. This one's a good one. So, look, of those cars you're looking at, the other thing to keep in mind with ride quality is Australians love big wheels and low-profile tyres. They love the look of that, but that's another way to go ruining your ride. So the minute you put very obviously small or slim tyres and you haven't got much air between the outside of the tyre and the wheel, it's going to bump around more. So when you're looking around, whichever one you go for, try and pick one with higher-profile tyres. You get a little bit more compliance there too. Yeah. So in terms of those two, I'd probably stick the Seltos a fraction ahead, but certainly the Mazda wins in some ways. Things like drivetrain refinement, and so the engine and transmission refinement, and also the interior presentation on the Mazda is better. But the warranty and the space and so on in the Kia are a step up. And as I said, from a value perspective, it's probably a step ahead.
Right.
So if I were to go for a sedan, what would be an equivalent sort of car?
Things like Kia Cerato that we were just chatting about. If you want something with a little bit more space, something like a Honda Civic or Subaru Impreza. So those two have got a bit more rear space and so on as well. So they're also worth looking. Toyota Corolla is also a good car now too, albeit with not a whole lot of rear seat space. It certainly hasn't got the space of those other two, but it's also a good package.
Sure. Okay. All right, Joe. Thanks, mate.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe. Bye-bye. 1-300-800-222. Couple of texts. Phil, the Tesla profit is from a guy who accidentally bought 100 cars. That's probably right. Our recent massive car sales, somehow like the panic buying of toilet paper.
I don't think it's quite that bad.
Are they running out of cars? Maybe. Why don't manufacturers repurpose glove boxes into phone boxes as docks for phones? Says Paul from Sale. Yeah, I love it. Yeah, maybe. you got to have somewhere to put stuff in the car. That's the thing, you know. And
well, it's
also, you got to have somewhere to keep junk, Toby, don't you? I mean, like, what's your glove box for except to be occasionally cleaned out of all the junk that's accumulated in there?
See, I have my wife and I are opposite with cars. She keeps the house very neat and tidy, but she doesn't take a whole lot of interest in what the car looks like. I'm the opposite. The car's got to be perfect.
Yes.
Not as fussed about the house. We're actually a good pair in that regard.
So you're sleeping in the car mostly by the sound.
Yeah. Indeed. But it's you're right. I mean, look, the things like storage in cars is something that some car makers just overlook completely. I mean, the Mercedes-Benz X-Class, the ute that they've just finished manufacturing, so many times in a commercial vehicle, you get some really clever hidey holes and storage areas because they think about the people that are using them, couriers and tradies and so on, who want to have, you know, clipboards and all sorts of stuff flying around the cabin, so they have little spaces for them. Mm. That Mercedes-Benz X-Class was useless in terms of the interior layout. They did not think about it at all, even to the point where you struggle to find somewhere to put a phone. Like, you look around going, well, who of these people is not going to have a phone, and they haven't thought about it? So that sort of stuff, as I said, some cars are really clever with it. Other ones just almost completely overlook it.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. Susanna, hello. Hi, Susanna.
Hi.
Hi.
I've had a sort of a mechanical question about the Nissan X-Trail 2006.
Well, we're not really doing mechanicals, but Susanna, let's see how we go.
Okay, so it's using oil. There's a leak from the oil cooler.
Yeah.
And it's probably the O-ring, which is like a big tap washer.
Yep.
And I've had a quote, $1,800 to replace the oil cooler because they won't sell the O-ring.
And who did you go to a Nissan dealer for that?
Yeah. I've been looking on the internet and it's a common problem.
So go to a small mechanic. Go to a local mechanic, a smaller mechanic. Tell them what the problem is. Tell them what the Nissan dealer's told you. Particularly with older cars, I tend to find, anecdotally speaking to people, that when it comes to, what is it, a 14-year-old car, they're not that interested in dealing with it. And they're more set up to go doing your standard services and all that sort of stuff. So I'm not saying I don't know that specific problem and whether you can get an O-ring for it and just replace the O-ring, but you're a much better chance at a small mechanic to have that sort of thing sorted out. I had a recent thing with a car where I saw a quote for $2,500 for a similarly, you know, a decent sized part, but it was a replace the part for $2,500, a couple of parts. Went to another mechanic and he found a part for $150, a brand new original part for $150 and a little bit of labour, and I think I got out of it with a service for $700. So compare that with $2,500. So I would definitely be looking around with that. And even if you're not, you know, go to two mechanics and get a quote. But the short story is they don't have to do the diagnosis. You've had the diagnosis. You can go to them and say, this is the part. And you'll find, I just find they tend to be a little bit more innovative. They tend to think about it as, you know, hey, we're trying to save this person some money.
There's a manufacturer who might be able to come up with an O-ring.
What's that, sorry?
A seal manufacturer in Victoria who might be able to come up with an O-ring.
The other thing you'll find is the manufacturer stores, so the dealer stores for that particular brand, they will not step outside the original parts that they have to use as part of their dealer agreement, whereas the other mechanic might say, I found this part, or they might go to a wrecking yard and find a spare part, whatever. So you're a much better chance to get that down through a smaller mechanic.
Okay, Susanna, thank you, and good luck with that. Alan, g'day.
Hello.
Hello, Alan.
Yeah, g'day. Your guest started talking at the beginning of the session about electric vehicles. It seems to me that, I'm sure we're all going to be driving electric vehicles eventually, but it seems to me that a lot of people would be wary because it seems that the technology is quite unresolved. On the one hand, we've got battery-powered electric vehicles. On the other hand, we've got hydrogen-powered vehicles. And the trouble with hydrogen-powered vehicles is, I think, my understanding is most of the time, the hydrogen is manufactured in coal-fired power plants, which kind of defeats the purpose of having a low-emission vehicle. And with the battery-powered vehicles, I heard on ABC Radio National, which I must say is a very good station, a couple of Australian scientists saying that they're developing a new kind of lithium battery, which is a combination of lithium and sulfur, which apparently will last four times longer than current lithium batteries.
There's a lot of work being done in batteries, I can tell you that.
And so, yeah, it seems to me that, you know, most people will be looking for more resolution of the technology. What are your thoughts on that?
So, yeah, look, I agree, and there's a few different points there. The first is you touched on, obviously, between battery electric vehicles, or what most people would consider an electric vehicle, and the hydrogen electric vehicles that are a hydrogen fuel cell that then use the hydrogen as effectively the energy storage instead of a battery. So those two technologies, will live in harmony moving forward, and all the car makers are saying they see that as well in terms of...
So they'll be together? There'll be two types of...
Absolutely, yeah. And you'll see them, I think, for different applications. So, for example, hydrogen fuel cell tends to work, or most people think it will work better in heavy duty applications.
Like trucks.
Your trucks tearing up and down the Hume Highway, for example, carrying big weight, we're having all those big heavy batteries and having to charge them at the end of each one is going to be a challenge. So that's where that will potentially work well. The battery electric vehicles potentially work better for a lot of regular passenger cars and obviously around town duties and so on. So it's not going to be an either or with that. It's going to be, I think, both of them. And obviously you've then got a third one in there, which is the plug-in hybrid electric vehicles. So that's teaming a petrol engine or a diesel engine with an electric motor, which we've got quite a few of. We're going to see many of those over the next decade as well. So you're going to see a lot of that technology. And as I said, you're not going to be choosing one over the other. It'll be all together. The second one is about the technology and the pace of change, and I guess when it will level out. And this is absolutely an issue for electric vehicles because the technology has moved so quickly in the last 5 years. You see how much more they're getting out of a battery pack these days and how much more affordable the cars are. And yes, absolutely. A lot of people say, well, how about I just wait another year or two or three and I'll potentially get a better car. So all that's at play, absolutely. And we're not going to go taking all these cars up tomorrow or even next year. It's going to be a slow burn. But competition is going to or the offerings on the table are going to be a lot greater. The other thing coming into this, which is interesting, and I've got this from a few people chatting over the last couple of weeks, is they actually think COVID-19 could benefit electric cars in a weird sort of way, because you've got a lot of people who potentially would have taken a trip overseas, who potentially have a fair bit of money, retirees and so on, may have gone for a big trip overseas. All of a sudden they say, no, hang on, we'll hang around town, I'll buy a better car, but I want to buy one that's going to be better for the environment. I want to look after the environment for my children or my friends and family. So they're thinking that way. The other way you're getting it is Public transport, obviously, a lot of people are wary about catching public transport with the virus still kicking around. And again, some people who take public transport from an environmental perspective are saying, well, maybe I'll now go and buy a more environmentally friendly car instead. So the early evidence suggests that electric cars, albeit very small in terms of the overall sales, have not been hit as hard by this coronavirus as regular petrol and diesel cars. So, it's extremely interesting to watch it all unfold. But as I said, I don't think that's going to change the fact that we're on a long road here. But, you stare down the road 50 or 100 years and it's difficult to see petrol and diesel still being in the mix.
That's much as true. All right, Al. Thank you. Thanks, Alan. Daniel's got a very basic question. Yes, Daniel?
Yeah, hi, mate. I was just wondering what would be the best type of car to get for about $3,000.
A $3,000 card.
$3,000?
Three grand car, Toby. We're not going to get a lot here, but what are we...
Stuff like that.
What's that?
It's sort of not.
Just to get to work and back?
Yep.
What would be the best type of car and where to look for that type of car?
Look, I would be... So the biggest thing you're looking at, when you're looking at cars below $5,000, the cheaper end of the market, the single biggest thing you're looking for is mechanical condition.
Yep.
You're not as worried about parking dings and all that sort of stuff. You're not as worried about the interior presentation, but you are worried that it's been serviced properly, that it's been vaguely looked after, and that it probably doesn't have more than, say, 200,000 kilometres on it, if you can get something like that. I'd be sticking to more the Japanese brands, and I'd be going for... Well, the smaller the car you get, the better in a way. So some of those light cars, and I'm thinking things like Toyota Echos and Yaris's, Kia Rio, that sort of thing. If you head back to those sorts of cars, a Hyundai Getz even, something like that. So if you can pick up something like that, that has been, as I said, looked after to some extent. You are by no means going to buy a perfect car there, but something like that will probably do you fairly well. In terms of where to buy it, I mean, the two main ones, Gumtree and Carsales are the two big ones. Gumtree's certainly done pretty strongly in the bottom end of the market in that the cheaper cars, so it's worth having a look there. But, I think my favourite out of all of that is keep an ear to the ground, hit your social media channels and your friends on social media and say, does anyone know of someone getting rid of a cheap car or just need a cheap runaround? And you'd be surprised. Often it pops up. Someone says, oh, I've got a friend down the road who's going to sell something. And at least you've got a vague idea of the history of the car then. So it's not bad. And the other thing is a lot of people, when they go to trade in a car, an older car, 15-year-old car or something, the dealer won't offer them much. They'll often offer them $1,000, maybe $2,000.
It's usually not worth giving it to a dealer, is it? No,
that's right. So say to them, okay, the dealer offered you $2,000, I'll give you $3,000.
Yep.
It's a win-win for everyone. So sure.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Daniel. Good luck with it. Tim from Cairns, g'day.
Yeah, g'day, lads. Basically looking at the comparison between, you got the LDV, the four-wheel drive dual cab, we got the Triton, and we got the Mazda BT50. Couple of negatives we have heard with the LDV was, one, rust, and two, was a bit of a turbo lag. But between the three, there's the 2019, 2020 models, all around about the 40 from what we've looked at. What would be your recommendation, and what's the goods and bads?
I actually haven't driven an LDV ute for quite some time. I've driven the D90, which is their larger SUV. I've driven that recently, and that certainly had the turbo lag issue. It had that real delay, particularly coming out of an intersection or something like that. You go to hit the accelerator, you just have to be thinking a second or two ahead about where you want to go. So it is frustrating. Once you're up and moving, it's not too bad, but it's certainly frustrating off the line. So as I said, I think they might share the same engine, so you're probably going to experience the same problems there. Haven't heard about the rust issue. That'll be one that, often the chat rooms and so on, which is probably where you've seen it, would give you some insight into that. So all that considered, I'd be looking at one of the other two. The BT50, as we talked about earlier, there's a new generation car coming. So that car, the current car, is in runout, and they are sharpening their pencils a little bit with those. So there's some reasonable deals there. It's a bigger car inside than the Triton, and it's a much more comfortable back seat than the Triton. So the being obviously the same as the Ford Ranger, it has an excellent back seat, whereas a lot of those utes are pretty compromised in the rear. And nothing like the turbo lag. The B BT50 is completely opposite. It's actually pretty pretty energetic the minute you step on it. So that 3.25 cylinder is pretty good. But if it was my money, I'd be shopping between the Triton and the BT50. If you don't need the extra space, the Triton will probably give you a fraction more for your money in terms of features. It'll certainly give you the latest active safety features, which the Mazda doesn't have yet. But as I said, I'm talking the active safety here, the passive safety. So if you're having a crash, the Mazda certainly got it all. If you're trying to avoid a crash, the Triton has things like auto emergency braking and those sorts of things. So it's got a couple of extra crash avoidance systems in there. I'd be shopping those two, seeing what the best deal you can get is. But both of them are solid buying.
Okie doke. Robert, hello.
Hello.
Hi, Robert.
Yeah, Toby, a few weeks ago, you mentioned something about the gearboxes on a Fiat Ducato were there was something, but I missed your story and I just wasn't quite sure what you said. My interest is I've got a motorhome with one.
Yep. So it's basically a lot of them have got these. So you hear about these twin clutch transmissions that, you know, Volkswagen markets it as DSG. A lot of the brands have got them these days on various models. So it's all done. The main reason they select these transmissions are for performance and fuel economy or wrap it all into efficiency. So they're a more efficient transmission. You lose less energy in the transmission than a regular torque converter automatic. But there are compromises along the way. So it's the compromises tend to be in sometimes in smoothness, shift smoothness, and so on. So, and the Ducatos, I know it's probably been 18 months, 2 years since I've driven a Ducato, but it certainly didn't have the initial progression and take up of some of the regular transmissions. So it was more talking about it from that perspective, not from a reliability perspective or anything. It was just talking about it from a general drivability perspective. The last ones I drove were not as good as the rivals, let's put it that way.
Oh, yeah. Okay, Toby. No, see, mine's with a motorhome and I tow a small Susie Swift behind it. And
yep.
Everything seems to be okay until I sort of come down in speed and come down into your 70 kilometres, 60 kilometre areas where it sort of just seems to take a little bit too the gear changes. But
to down change, that's right.
It sort of seems to smooth out after that. Oh, no, what I was worried about was I only got part of the story that night, and I was just sort of worried about reliability.
All right, Robert, I hope we put your mind at rest there. Gail, g'day.
Hi, Philip. Thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
Toby, I'm really interested in your views, please, on the new Volkswagen T-Cross. I haven't driven the 1 litre model yet, but I'm really interested in it because my husband and I are both really tall. So that's part of the question. I know there's a bigger engine coming out later in the year, the four-cylinder 1.4 litre, but I'm also worried about whether Volkswagen have cured their gearbox problems yet.
So it has got one of those twin clutch, the DSG transmissions. In terms of the issues they've had, yes, Volkswagen has made enormous strides in terms of not only making them more robust, but also looking after customers better if there have been issues with them. So I wouldn't have as much of an issue with that perspective. What is worth trialing, and I think you'll notice this as soon as you get in it, it does have that hesitation and a real laziness initially when you go to step on the throttle. So it's actually transmission laziness. It's not engine laziness. It's got a sport mode. When you put it in the sport mode, that does cure it to some extent, but then it ends up holding gears a bit more. So that's my biggest issue with it. In terms of you and your husband being quite tall, plenty of space. I fit in one, no problems, and it's there's loads of space in them. Not so much in the back seat. The back seats are pretty tight, but certainly the front seats are fine. It's an interesting move for Volkswagen, though. It's the first Volkswagen I've driven in probably about 15 years that you can really notice where they're trying to save some money. So whereas you get in previous, whether it was a Tiguan or a Golf or whatever, and they had a really high quality interior. It was pretty much either top of its class or close to top of its class. They really did present them nicely inside. The T-Cross is the first one I've driven where you get in and you can see where they're starting to save money. Some of the plastics are a bit hard. Yeah, it doesn't have things like digital radio tuning, which is fairly minor given you can stream them through an app these days anyway. But but things like that, it's just you're just starting to get a hint of that. That said, it's obviously very affordable. The engine, once you get going, the engine's terrific. Little three-cylinder turbo that's you get really nice sort of mid-range pull in it. So performance-wise around town, it's great. It's a good little transmission, good little gearbox. But as I said, that initial laziness, you'll certainly notice that. And that's to some people might be frustrating. A good test for it, simulate a stop-start on a hill, for example. Imagine you're in traffic on a hill and just crawl up the hill. Oh, not so much air conditioning because the engine itself will pull okay. It's more the transmission, the initial engagement of the transmission. And the other thing is do some three-point turns. So just, again, you know, imagine you're turning and then have to grab reverse and, again, you'll feel some of that hesitation there. So it's more noticeable with these twin-clutch automatics. It's more noticeable in the smaller engines. So that delay, that hesitation, you tend to feel it more in the smaller engines with less power than you do in the bigger engines with a lot of power. So it's, as I said, that one's not a high-powered engine. It's a great, characterful engine. It's works really nicely in that car, but as I said, the initial takeoff needs a bit of work.
Okay. All right,
and would that be true of the four-cylinder 1.4 litre two, Cody?
Haven't driven that one. That's a it'll be the same engine that's in Tiguan and Golf and all those sorts of things. So if it adheres to those ones, it'll be not quite as bad, but there'll still be a bit of it.
Yeah, sure. Look, I appreciate it. Thanks, Philip. Thanks, Toby.
Thanks, Gail. Bye. What are Toby's thoughts on the two engines, 2 litre and 2.5 litre in the new Mazda CX-30, says Fiona from Hobart.
So the 2 litre, in some ways, I think, in some ways, a sweeter engine, but the 2.5 certainly pulls a little bit stronger. So it's same with the with CX-5 as well. So you just notice it's more noticeable in the CX-5, where it's obviously a heavier, bigger, heavier car. So in the CX-5, I think you get a bigger benefit from going to the 2.5. In the CX-30, you can get away with the 2 litre. That said, if you're going to be sitting on a freeway at 110 or you know, in country roads, you'll just have to rev it a bit more to get going. It actually revs quite cleanly. It's got a reasonable amount of power, but just doesn't quite have that mid-range surge, that pull that you expect in the mid-range. But as I said, for around town, zipping around generally, 2 litre will be fine.
Mm. Okie doke. All right, John, Kia Stingers.
Oh, yes. Good evening, gentlemen. About 4 or so years ago, I came across a car on approach. I thought it was a new Jaguar sports car of some description. Mm-hmm. And on approach, I found out that it had a Kia badge. Did my research to find out that it was a Kia Stinger. Yep. Then the world was inundated with a giant advertising campaign. Those rambunctious BBC motoring writers gave it about 11.5 out of 10 and it won Car of the Year or something or other over there.
Yep.
And I haven't heard a thing since. This was in Manly. There is at an adjoining suburb, there is a very big Kia dealer. I haven't seen one since. What happened?
Well, it's on sale. It's been on sale in Australia since 2017.
One, So they're there, John.
Yeah. So look, they are around.
What I'm saying is it got off to this big bang.
Yeah.
And so I'm out and about. I walk 10 kilometres a day. I don't see them anywhere.
Mm. Yeah.
Has it proved unreliable, or is there some problem with it,
not at all. So the biggest issue is that it's playing in an enthusiast portion of the market. So it sells largely on driving enjoyment, on high performance. So it's a 3.3 litre engine. 272 kilowatts of power, so V8 like levels of power from a V6 twin turbo engine, and it's as I said, pitched more along driving enjoyment. For the people who are going in for a car of that size that they just want to do the job, they're going to have to pay another $10,000 or $15,000 to get into a Stinger. So it really is about the engine, the driving experience. And the reality is there's not as many people out there who are going to make it a top seller as a Holden Commodore or a Ford Falcon before it was. So it was playing in a much smaller proportion of the segment of the market. And to some extent, it's going up against things like a Ford Mustang. Yes, the Mustang's a different car. It's a two-door and it's a V8. But they're both trying to go for a similar buyer. Yeah, so it was never going to be a massive seller. They do sell, I think, 200 or 300 a month, something like that. Maybe it's a few less, 150 or something, but it just ticks along as doing its job as an enjoyable performance car. But it was never going to be an extremely high-volume vehicle. So that's probably why you're not seeing heaps of them around.
Thanks, John. Time's just about beaten us as well. Annette says, does Toby know of any car that has a button to press for the seat to push forward and back, please?
Lots
of them. Actually, lots of them do. Especially with seats that are all electrically operated, seats always have a button.
They do. Always have a button. The other thing is a lot of cars these days have the memory buttons, so you can have either two or three different memory settings for different drivers driving the cars. And something like a Subaru, so the latest Subaru Forester, it actually has facial recognition, so when you sit in the car,
Needs bum recognition.
It recognises the driver and then adjusts the seats, the sound system, the whole bit to how you left the car. Yes, there's plenty of cars that do that sort of thing.
We better wind it up. All right, Toby. Toby Hagen, editor of evcentral.com.au. Terrific, Toby. Talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good. Thanks.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.